Investors Chronicle.
Welcome to the Companies and Markets Show. It's Thursday, the 14th of September, as we record. This week, we are talking heavy industry and high income, beginning with a look at former turnaround specialist Melrose and its former subsidiary, Dowlais. We're discussing recent figures from both groups as they get accustomed to life as independent businesses. Then our cover feature this week is all about the various subsidies being provided to a variety of industries in the US in particular. We are going to ask what that might mean for companies' cost of capital and how investors should think about valuations in that context. Finally, given the big increase in the cost of borrowing seen over the past year, we look at some of the investment trusts that are now trading on pretty chunky yields themselves and ask what kind of opportunity they present for investors. Joining me to discuss all of this are, over the line, Julian Hoffman.
Hello, Dan.
And in the studio, Mike Fahey.
Hi, Dan.
James Norrington.
Hello.
And Leonora Walters.
Hello.
Hi, everyone. Melrose, as I said at the top, a former turnaround specialist nowadays. We'll get to the ins and outs of that in a minute, but how did the figures themselves look the other day, Mike?
Yeah, very healthy. Revenue was up by about 20%. There was a 5.7% increase in its operating margin. Its adjusted operating profit for the main aerospace business, which is the core of it now, was up to $175 million, more than double last year's $67 million. I took a look at Melrose last year in the ideas section just before they announced this split and the hiving off of the Dowlais business. And the kind of key driver for the company really is this, like Rolls-Royce, they have these risk and revenue sharing partnerships, they call them, these long-term contracts for engine maintenance on planes where in the early years of the contracts, there's a lot of work done in getting the engines ready for flying. And then in the later years, they generate a ton of cash and become much, much more profitable. And when we spoke to Melrose's chief operating officer, soon to become the CEO, he said that these contracts, after a couple of years where they were really chugging along for two reasons. One, because they were in the early stage, but two, because flying hours were massively reduced because of the state of the global airline industry. After that, they are now in a much healthier position. He said of the 19 current contracts they've got, 17 are in profit.
Yeah, and I think full-year guidance was raised as well in the figures. So, you know, clearly that aerospace improvement is coming through. And that is really the bulk of the business now, you know, the buy, improve, sell. They're trying to move on from that now that, you know, GKN Automotive, Dowlais has been spun off.
Yeah.
You know, so that are all their hopes pretty much now pinned on aerospace? So their fortunes just tied completely to that? You know, how does the business look now they've done that?
Well, I think to take a step back, GKN was the fourth kind of major engineering group that they bought. You know, this is a group that kind of floated on AIM as a cash shell back in 2004. And each time they've done one of these buy, improve, sell transactions, they've been much bigger and bigger in scope. And GKN, there was quite a fierce battle for it. There were massive union objections at the time it was done. It was a big deal, $8.1 billion. And there were certain conditions that went with it, one of which I believe was that they couldn't sell off the aerospace division or break up the business within the first 5 years. Now, as it turned out, the global pandemic meant that both of the key markets that they bought with the GKN business, automotive on one side and aerospace on the other, had a torrid time. And although they did do a lot of work on restructuring in both of them and in consolidating sites, in making redundancies. You know, it's accused of being an asset stripper, it says, as it says, improve in the middle of that buy, improve, sell model. So it was doing all of this work, but the results still look terrible because there's no cash coming in both instances. So by the time they got to this time last year when we were looking at this as an investment case, the combined value of the business was still $5.6 billion. It was well below what they bought it for after years of seeming improvements. And there was no quick way out. So this idea of the spin-off was kind of forced out of necessity rather than any grand plan to change the buy, improve, sell model.
Julian, you used to cover Melrose, I think, way back when. What's your view on the current iteration of the business?
Yeah, I covered them back in 2005. It was one of my salad days. It's an interesting development that they've decided to effectively to become the business that they bought, which is what's happened with GKN. By spinning it off rather than sort of breaking it up, it sort of lays the marker down that that's the end of that's the end of the show, folks. And I don't think they really have any other choice. And as Mike pointed out, they were a cash shell to start with, and they've got to the point where it's quite difficult to see how another larger entity is going to come along and buy it. So it's reached its natural conclusion as a buyout company, which I think is incredibly interesting, because you don't see that process very often. It must be, I think, one of the few cases where an entity has gone from virtually nothing to so big that it's unsellable, and that's a very interesting development as far as I can tell. But yes, I like the fact that they've spun it off, because Double A is an interesting play on whether kind of a legacy businesses still have a future. So they're very much into the heavy drivetrain side of automotive. It's very much associated with combustion engines and high carbon emissions. So that it'll be interesting how it copes now with the changeover towards a sort of EV type future or electric vehicle type future, which really is the prize that is available there, really. And it remains to be seen how that market develops, because China is the growing dominantly growing player in the electric vehicle development, but the EU is gearing up for a trade fight. That could be an outcome that might affect its prospects for the future, possibly even to the positive.
We'll come to Dowlais in a bit more detail in a minute, but before we do, I just wanted to focus on Melrose and the valuation, Mike, because in the past few months, certainly since the spin-off and just before that, it's really shot back up share price-wise. So, I think we still have it on a buy. I think the idea being, the growth prospects are stronger now, notwithstanding that higher valuation.
Yep.
Is that a fair summary? How do you kind of see how it's traveled?
It is a fair summary. It has increased massively in value. This was part of the kind of reason from the Melrose point of view for this demerger, I think. The idea that it will be seen as a standalone entity as something, well, if we looked again with fresh eyes, I think there's quite a lot maybe of negativity around Dowlais and how some analysts saw its ability to cope with the EV transition, which we can come on to. But from the Melrose point of view, there's been that focus on its cash generation. It's trading pretty much at the top of its cycle in terms of PE. But when you look at its future projections for the amount of cash it's generating from these RRSPs, from these engine contracts, there's still plenty more to go. And it's still not quite finished with the restructuring efforts as well. They are still doing some work in the US in terms of consolidating sites. It's although it is at the top end of its historic PE, I think its historic PE is maybe weighed down by what's gone on in the past 4 or 5 years, and it probably deserves a slightly higher rating.
Let's turn to Dowlais then. As both Mike, you and Julian have been saying, the EV transition, is key to its future. The early signs from the figures it released just a couple of days ago suggest it is making the most of that at this stage. What did you make of those?
Yeah, it's had I think it's had some quite chunky orders for EVs. There was one mentioned for an SUV, doesn't name which SUV, but it described it as a 3-in-1 order. And this is something that it's talked about as it's become an independent company. It's recent Capital Markets Day. It was talking about being able to generate more value from different parts of the propulsion systems, having more of the propulsion system as its own rather than being mainly known for either prop shafts or drive shafts or small parts of an entire combustion engine. But from that combustion engine heritage, I mean, it's used by something like half of global manufacturers. It's got a real position of strength. And the point Julian was talking about earlier about a trade fight, I think whatever happens there, it's kind of well positioned. It's got factories all over the world. It doesn't need to pick a side in a trade dispute, I don't think.
Yeah, this is the EU announcing an anti-subsidy probe into China's EVs this week.
Yeah, it's still very early stage.
Yeah, yeah. Obviously, that Chinese nascent dominance is really starting to turn heads, and clearly the EU has decided it wants to have a look in a bit more detail. Dowlais itself too seemed like it probably was going to raise full year guidance, were it not for the fact that there's the possibility of some strike action in the US.
Yep.
How material a threat might that be?
It's always, when you look at something like this in advance, it's always easy to dismiss it as a small thing. The UAW, the big union covering the car makers in America, talking about a strike at the big three firms, which is Ford, GM, and the old Chrysler business, which is now part of this Stellantis group that contains Fiat and Peugeot and lots of other car makers. But the analysts seem fairly sanguine on it so far. They think there would have been maybe an increase of about 5% or so to guidance were it not for this UAW strike, and that the company's been quite cautious. But given that they're only talking about a difference of 5% or so, suggests that it's maybe not going to be a long-term issue, or it's certainly not seen as massively detrimental.
And what about the valuation to conclude for Dowlais? How does that stack up?
Again, I think it's much more lowly valued than Melrose, but for quite obvious reasons. Its margins are still fairly low, and its auto margins are 6.5%, which isn't great. Its long-term target is 11. It's still quite some way off that, but it's still in a market that is recovering from the semiconductor shortage, and production levels, although increasing, are still massively below 2019 levels, and its own profitability is still lower than 2019 levels. So the valuation it has kind of reflects where it is in the cycle. Of course, there are when you look at the kind of big picture for car sales, there are fears that, you know, the general economic environment might weaken that going into next year. But it is still a market that's held up well so far, and it's held up well because there's been a lack of inventory, and that car makers are still trying to catch up, really, from the lag caused by COVID.
Well, one of the issues coming up for Dowlais and all companies like it, as we've discussed, is the potential, butting of heads between countries, subsidies and anti-subsidy probes and what have you. And China is not the only country, providing subsidies to key industries. Of course, the EU is doing it itself. And so too is the US, as we've discussed a lot in print and on this show over the past couple of years via the likes of the Inflation Reduction Act. Our cover feature this week looks at that in a bit more detail, or rather from a certain angle. James, you wrote the cover feature looking at the concept of crowding out or crowding in, and looking at companies' cost of capital. Obviously, we're in a situation now where interest rates have risen. At the same time, government spending on some of these programs seems to be increasing quite markedly too. So it's kind of a reversal of what we've seen over the past decade. Can you sort of lay out sort of your thinking behind the feature and what you've tried to set out to do with it?
Well, really, it's sort of the fundamental question for investors is you know, what's your rate of return going to be on an investment? And there's a symbiotic relationship with companies, of course, because investors' rate of return is what it costs a company to raise capital. It's basically, it's the, if you think of it, it's sort of the incentive of that a company is giving investors to provide them with finance for projects. And that's obviously, cost of capital has spiked in the last year. And that's happened really on the back of inflation expectations. We know that the headline inflation was very much driven by sort of, you know, an event like Russia invading Ukraine. And there's obviously, you know, the issues with coming out of the pandemic with supply chain disruption. But as we move forward, the return of the big state and subsidies, it sort of reignites some old debates about whether state intervention, state spending is ultimately inflationary, and whether that will knock-on effect that will have is structurally higher inflation and therefore, you know, a constant upward pressure putting a floor under companies' cost of capital. And what does that mean for companies? The theory is not sort of cut and dried. There's you know, there's different schools of thought, obviously. Keynesian economics would argue that increasing states acting to increase aggregate demand with subsidy leads to a multiplier effect in the economy, or a crowding in, if you will. But obviously in the 1970s, the idea that gained most traction was this idea of crowding out, whereby the government raising demand for money, so there's a supply and demand element with money, and also the impact of their spending and the way they funded it, which is through debt markets would require a higher yield, but also they, you know, they need taxes to raise taxes to fund their borrowing, or to make their borrowing sustainable rather. That effectively raised the cost of capital for companies, and therefore made them reluctant to do projects. So in effect, the private sector is being crowded out by the public sector. And now, if you move fast forward to now, the issue sort of it's moved. Is it so much crowding in or crowding out, or is it an issue of market failure? Where you would look at something like, if you look at supply chains and semiconductors, for example, something the US CHIPS Act was enacted to address, where, you know, the market has failed in a way because just left up to its own devices, it's gone to the cheapest issue. And now we have a huge supply bottleneck with semiconductors all going massively dependent on Taiwan, with all the geopolitical risk that entails. And another example, you know, perhaps the granddaddy of them all in terms of externalities, climate change, which the Inflation Reduction Act in part is targeted at addressing from a US perspective, and which has definitely set the cat among the pigeons with state subsidies around the world, evoking sort of, you know, response from the EU and other bodies, and China obviously is a planned economy itself anyway.
In the piece you talk about, so far, the kind of the announced output or results, if we can put it so crudely, from both of these acts, the CHIPS Act and the Inflation Reduction Act. And so far, the former, despite the latter having a lot more attention, arguably, the former is the one that's produced more results at this stage, at least in terms of what's been announced or being touted.
Well, it's so the CHIPS Act, I mean, obviously, you know, we've the whole market has been set alight by artificial intelligence, and we've all seen what's happened to sort of the stock prices of companies like Nvidia. We've got, you know, ARM listing. But, you know, $53 billion was the CHIPS Act, and $166 billion of private investment has been announced since then. Now, how much of that the government program wants to take credit for, given the incentive of the AI boom and everything. But you know, that suggests a sort of a strong crowding in narrative. It's a lot of some. It's focused at reshoring to incentivize, you know, the market where the market has failed to actually break the US free of some of these supply bottlenecks. Long term strategic, obviously. I mean, I don't think, you know, you're not going to get away from Taiwan and semiconductors overnight. But you know, this is an important sort of strategic event. Something like the Inflation Reduction Act, I mean, it's more controversial. I mean, $369 billion in subsidies. It's had sort of Yeah, the direct sort of crowding in investments being much, much lower in terms of clean energy projects with that, but although there have been some other benefits. Unfortunately, obviously, it's so political, so you do see some quite dishonest headlines where people who are desperate for the IRA to be seen as a success are lumping in the subsidy, the crowding in effect of the CHIPS Act with the crowding in effect of the Inflation Reduction Act, which is quite dishonest. But that's not to say that further down the line, the Inflation Reduction Act won't have a very important role in potentially, you know, if it is successful in creating clean and secure energy supply for the United States, then that will have a big economic boost going down the line.
And the second part of the piece is you know how all this might feed into the cost of capital, companies, cost of capital, and it's interesting angle. I think one of the people you quote in the piece, the Stern University professor, says, I know that in the last decade it's been very fashionable to attribute powers to the Fed that it does not have and view it as the ultimate arbiter of rates. Obviously, we're still kind of in that mindset now with interest rates being increased, but really, you know, the path of the cost of capital ultimately is being set by expected inflation, expected growth.
Expectations of inflation are what drive the markets to demand the interest rates that they do. So it's a longer term. If you look at the 10-year bond and the spread over 10-year inflation protected bond yield versus over the nominal bond over the inflation protected, that gives you an idea of sort of the inflation expectations of the market. Now that, even though we do tend to you know watch with bated breath every time there's announcement of interest rates over the last 18 months, it's really there's a strong argument that you know in conjunction with looking at a lot of measures like sort of you know the tightness of labour markets etc. that central banks are sort of being led by market demands of interest rates of what the terminal rate may be, and that's effect is it puts a floor under you know what companies can raise because bond yields. Effectively, particularly the US Treasury rates, they're sort of the risk-free rate in sort of you know the capital asset pricing model, which is hugely influential in how all assets are priced. It puts a floor under the you know what companies can offer in terms of an interest rate, effective interest rate with a gross redemption yield on their bonds. So that the cost of debt finance raises. In turn, it also means that the equity premium that shares have to offer over risk-free government bonds is higher, and that implies that share prices must be lower, you know, all things remaining equal, unless, you know, earnings are going through the roof. So therefore, you know, that your cost of raising finance as a company is higher, which that does a couple of things. I mean, one, it raises the hurdle rate for any projects that you're you're looking to invest in. So in a sense, if projects are unattractive because you can't get a return, that's sort of, you know, crowding out in practice if you want to look at it that way. But the other thing is also past choices you've made in terms of your capital structure. If you're debt heavy, then you need to deleverage because the cost of rolling that debt over is higher, which again, you know, it causes a general retraction in terms of you know your strategy as a business, which and that obviously affects which companies are best to own shares in from an investor point of view.
Yeah, one thing you talk about in the piece as well is you know looking at the weighted average cost of capital versus return on invested capital is one good way to examine how that balance might be shifting for certain companies.
Yeah, I mean it's kind of you know the best keep on going really. I mean, if we did this just a brief table example of Diageo, which obviously is a high quality company, high return on invested capital, and yeah, actually has used its debt in its capital structure. But that's a company like that has a high return invested capital. Its weighted average cost of capital, it will be affected, but because it has a sort of a lower than its beta is less than one, so it's basically a less volatile company than the market. Its cost of equity is a little bit lower anyway, and obviously a good quality company with stable cash flows and good earnings, and is able to borrow at the lower rate that it can. So it's not, it will affect some other companies that are are worse off down the food chain, really, in terms of credit quality. But that's not good for the economy as a whole, because, you know, you've got less investment going on. You've got banks that are exposed to companies with worse credit. Which basically means that has a knock-on effect of how much they're going to be able to loan out to everybody, really. So ultimately it feeds into growth and everything. So that's the ultimate sort of crux of it is are we headed is this wonderful sort of state intervention which will have a wonderful growth effect in the economy and we're headed for sunny uplands, are we crowding out investment in the private sector and setting ourselves up for a fall? And that's where the jury's out, because, you know, and obviously it's very emotive given we're talking about issues such as climate change with the IRA.
On the subject of the cost of capital and the risk-free rate, another piece in the publication this week looks at funds and the yields available to income investors, because obviously the onus is on them to offer a high yield now that the risk-free rate is at 5%. Equally, though, Leonora, you wrote this piece, investors should be aware, if they're not already, that a high yield, of which there are several now, you know, pretty chunky yields out there, well, more than several in the investment trust space, that isn't a guarantee. And, you know, you shouldn't just lap up, you shouldn't just look for the highest yield you can find. Can you say a bit more about some of the considerations we look at in the piece in the context of high-yielding funds about what to look for and what to be aware of?
Yes. I mean, I think the bottom line is there's no point having a trust which generates income but is losing capital value. Total return is far more important because, quite simply, you can create your own income by selling units or shares in investments that have grown. High yields can also indicate a problem with an investment trust or the assets it's invested in, or the assets that the trust invests in. Or it could be also an indication that the market of investors think the investment trust is going to cut its dividend.
And what about some of the warning signs then that, you know, or some of the checks you can do to make sure you're, as insofar as is possible, you know, you're not picking one of these, you know, yield traps that is going to cut its dividend?
Yeah, I think with an investment trust, most importantly, check its most recent annual or half year report to see if the income it gets from its investments is enough to pay its planned dividends for the year. And if this isn't the case, then you should have a look and see if the investment trust has revenue reserves, because trusts can hold back up to 15% of their income a year and build a revenue reserve to maintain or increase dividends in years when the income from investments doesn't cover it. Another option for the investment trust, and this would be set out again in its reports, would be to use capital to pay the dividends. So if it can do these things, either of these things, then, you know, it might not be such an issue if it's not getting income from its investments. That said, what's really important there is its policy. You know, it might have the ability to use capital, it might have a revenue reserve. If its board isn't minded to, you know, maintain or increase the dividend, it won't do it. So there should be statements in the trust's reports on its policy towards dividends and what its board's latest view is on maintaining or raising the dividend and its plans for the current financial year. I think a good indicator again as well is a trust and its board's record. If it's got a strong record of doing that, you think, well, you know, why should they deviate this year? If they're simply doing it, perhaps it's never done it before, think, you know, is this hot air? So yeah, they're all important things to look at.
I suppose as well, we should consider this in the round insofar as, you know, a high yield can be concerning, but a lower yield, even in the context of 5% risk-free rates, isn't as bad as people may think nowadays, because there's the prospect of, you know, A, dividend growth, B, capital growth in a lot of cases as well. You know, these are movable feasts and something that could be compounding over a longer period of time. That said, though, you know, when you do see some double-digit yields out there, they do, you know, They are intriguing, in the least, and we do identify a few of those in the piece. Could we maybe sort of highlight one or two that are currently on, you know, really chunky yields at the moment?
Well, I'm actually the example I thought of highlighting wasn't double-digit yield or anything like that. I thought of highlighting Law Debenture Corporation. It's UK Equity Income Trust. And it doesn't have the highest yield out there. Closed yesterday, this was 3.76%. But, and this but's very important, more importantly, this trust has delivered really, really strong returns. It's run by a fund manager called James Henderson, who's got a fantastic record. He runs a number of funds, and he's done really well for his investors with Law Debenture Corporation. Also, Law Debenture Corporation has increased or maintained its dividend for over 40 years. And, for example, over the 10 years to the 31st of December 2022, its annual dividend payment increased 114%. I think if you're bearing in mind inflation, you know, long-term investing, you know, never mind the highest yield, dividend growth, you know, that's what you really want. And, you know, I mentioned that you should look at the documents. Well, if you look at this trust documents, you will see that the trust board said in July that it intends to either maintain at 30.5p a share or increase its dividend. And the trust had revenue reserves of 47 million at the end of its last financial year, and that will be enough to cover the planned dividends for this year 1.19 times, so more than enough.
I'm nonetheless going to go back to the subject of the double-digit yields. But you're right that, you know, that is certainly a more mainstream and, you know, probably more reliable, certainly with a longer track record investment trust. You know, Fair Oaks Income is one which we mentioned, which is you know, investing in CLOs. So that's the flip side, really, I suppose, of some of these high yields, is an opaque area, is a risky area, certainly at a time of economic uncertainty, which, again, just goes to show you need to be confident in the fundamentals of the trust rather than just buying it for that yield. I should wrap up as well, actually, by saying in print this week, we do look at one of the UK shares with a big yield at the moment, M&G, the only UK company with both a trailing and forward yield in excess of 10%. And again, that might seem like a, you know, is ringing some alarm bells, but Alex Newman, our ideas editor, looks at the fundamentals of the business and, you know, comes to a conclusion that things might not be as worrisome as that yield would have perhaps suggested in the past. So it really is all about those fundamentals, isn't it? And it's about looking at the company's strength. And we've got plenty of that in the magazine this week, along with all of our other features. But that does bring us to the end of today's show. So thank you very much to Leonora, to James, to Mike, and to Julian. And thank you to you for listening. We'll see you next time on another Companies and Markets show.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.